people who don't have a strong sense of meaning and purpose have more heart attacks, they have more stroke, they have more liver disease, they have more various stomach conditions, and so on. They live shorter lives, they have less longevity. Then they have more depression, more anxiety, more risky behaviors, alcohol, drugs, and so on, suicide, so on. That's all correlated with an insufficient sense of meaning and purpose. So that's why I wrote the book, Find Your Purpose Using Science.
That was Gleb Sapirsky, and this is the All Things Risk Podcast. Welcome and welcome back to the All Things Risk Podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. The All Things Risk Podcast is where I go deep and long form using the lenses of risk, resilience, uncertainty, and randomness to get into all types of very cool phenomena with the objective of providing you with some value, making your lives hopefully a little bit better or a little bit perhaps more insightful. Thank you for being with us. I hope you're all well, wherever you are, however you're listening to the show. We're back with another full episode, back in full force. Last week we had an in-between episode. This week it's another full episode. And as I tee up this conversation, I'm reminded of my very recent conversation with Mark Stoiber on episode 43, where we talked about brands. He's a branding expert. And if you listen to that one, you know that we talked about the importance of having a purpose. And this is something that is applicable and very important, not just to brands, but I think to all of us as individuals. And it not only makes us happier when we have a sense of purpose, but I think it makes us more resilient and better able to deal with uncertainty. And of course, that's one of the themes of the show. And this is precisely why we talk about this sort of stuff. So today we go deeper into this topic and we get into the how to do this in a way that's backed by science. My guest is Gleb Sapirsky. Gleb is a scholar. He is a professor at Ohio State University, which is in the United States. He teaches history and decision sciences. He's also an entrepreneur. He's an author. He's a coach. He's a speaker. He's an activist. And he focuses on things that work, things that are backed by science. And we spend the bulk of the conversation on purpose and techniques that are scientifically proven to help people find their purpose. He's written a book on the topic. And we also top and tail the conversation about purpose with some other interesting stuff. We get into Gleb's background in or being born in Moldova, which is in the former Soviet Union, and that has led to his earlier academic work on leisure in the former Soviet Union. Very interesting stuff, and we tie some strands that might be of interest to you if you caught the conversation with Tim Stanley on Russia. We spend the latter part of the conversation on decision-making, and Gleb has also done work in this area, and we talk about post-truth politics to wrap it all up, which is also a space where Gleb has done some work. He runs something called the Rational Politics Project and Intentional Insights, which helps people reach their goals through research-based content. So that's just a long-winded way of me saying that I'm super appreciative of people in academia like Gleb, because they don't stay in their ivory towers. They use and share their knowledge to help people. And I think you'll not only enjoy this, but you are going to get a lot of very good insights from this. Without any further delay, ladies and gentlemen, here's Gleb Sapirsky. Enjoy. Gleb, thank you for joining me on the All Things Risk Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you so much, Ben. I really appreciate you bringing me on to speak to you and your audience.
I think this is going to be a very fascinating conversation. You are involved in a variety of things. You're obviously a professor at Ohio State University in history and neuroscience, and we'll get into all of that. Before we do, where is your accent from, and where is your family name from?
Sure. So my accent is from the former Soviet Union, mm-hmm. and that's where my family name is from. I was born in the Republic of Moldova, in what was back then the former Soviet Union, and right now is an independent country, the Republic of Moldova. And my family immigrated from the former Soviet Union to the United States when I was 10.
Okay.
And I grew up in New York City.
Okay.
I decided not to drop my accent because I appreciate that's part of my cultural heritage. And it also makes me a little bit unique and is part of my public persona.
Okay, very, very cool. So you decided not to drop the accent. That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. So I guess it implies that you could speak with a North American accent if you put in the effort.
Of course. I mean, yeah. A lot of people chose to do that, and I never did that. I decided that I don't want to train myself away from my accent.
Right. Interesting. Okay, that already opens up a whole range of interesting things. I wanted to get into your so you are a professor of history, and I wanted to understand how you chose that path.
Yeah, so I'm a professor of history of behavioral science,
mm-hmm.
and so behavioral science involves a whole bunch of disciplines, and it involves things like psychology, behavioral economics, cognitive neuroscience, and things like philosophy, economics, things like sociology, anthropology. And why I chose the history of behavioral science? Well, there's no discipline called behavioral science. Mm-hmm. Behavioral science is just a conglomerate of stuff, of discipline that have to do with how people think and behave and feel. Mm. The history of behavioral science allows me to draw on a whole variety of disciplines and apply them to historical and contemporary contexts. So that's why I chose the history of behavioral science as my discipline.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Your chosen field of study, and I guess growing up in New York City as someone who was born in the former Soviet Union, I noticed that you had a monograph about youth, a book actually about youth in the Soviet Union, and I'm just wondering if there were some dots there that you managed to join up, and how and why that you did that.
Yes, so I was growing up in the New York City, and I had my cultural heritage, mm-hmm. which was Soviet kind of Russian background, mm-hmm. Moldovan. I decided to focus on youth in the Soviet Union as in the post-World War II Soviet Union, because that's sort of the generation of my grandparents and my parents, more my grandparents. And I focused on the era from 1945 to 1970 as the topic of my dissertation research.
Mm-hmm.
What I was seeking to understand was how people thought, felt, and behaved in community settings in the Soviet Union. The reason I was interested in the Soviet Union was, well, besides my cultural heritage, mm-hmm. is that it was the big alternative modernity to the United States, to the UK, to Germany, to all the other developed and capitalist countries. So the big alternative modernity was socialist. So things like the Soviet Union, China, and so on. And people in China and the Soviet Union lived really modern lives in many ways. They had a highly developed level of technology, but a very different society, very different social structural framework. So, but there's still people, you know, people here, people mm-hmm. there. And I grew up in the United States. That's where my adulthood came into being. So mm-hmm. I was really interested in learning, understanding how people thought and behaved differently in their youthhood in mm-hmm. community settings in the Soviet Union. So that's why I decided to focus on that topic and mm-hmm. bring the behavioral science tools that I learned from all of these other disciplines to that specific historical setting, which really allows me to have a much more rich understanding of the United States, of the UK, of Western developed nations, because I can look at them from an outside perspective and see, well, how do humans behave similarly and how do humans behave differently. So what's culturally particular about the UK and the US, and what's not? What's just part of the basic human experience? That's why I decided to focus on that.
That's really interesting, and I think we'll touch on some of these themes a little bit later on. But I'm interested in some of the, I guess, the differences and similarities. In terms of differences, I would imagine that in Soviet culture, the community and the collective is perhaps more important than the individual. And in Western societies, we obviously value the individual a lot more, which has its advantages and disadvantages. But I'm curious to, when you mentioned differences and similarities, what some of those were.
Yeah, so a really interesting similarity was in kind of community settings that people in the United States and in the UK and so on, we do have community settings. Now, there may be less, somewhat less important, but they're still pretty important us here. So, for example, churches and other club activities, they are really pretty important for people to have an experience that gets them the sense of community belonging. The sense of community belonging is still quite valuable here in the U.S. and in the U.K., and people find a sense of meaning and purpose in churches or in secular communities, you know. The Sunday Assembly movement is an example that has been really started in the UK, came here to the US where I'm based, and has been serving secular people as a way of community. We could see that its popularity speaks to the need for community even among secular people. And of course, churches provide that sense of community. Now, the Soviet Union didn't have churches, obviously. Well, no, not true. It had churches, but they weren't really state sponsored, they were frowned upon, and they were discouraged. So the Soviet Union still needed to provide people that sense of community, and that's what it did, is it provided community centers called clubs, where people got that sense of community. But they didn't get it in a religious setting, or kind of a faith-based spiritual setting. It was a place for people to get together, have friendships, do cultural activities that were sponsored by the state, and all sorts of, you know, dancing, music, theater, and so on, lectures, debates that people enjoyed, they got really engaged with, and they got that sense of community and belonging in those settings. So it's really, it's a, at the same time, a difference and a similarity. People still need a sense of community and belonging, and they still find a sense of meaning in that. But they get it in different ways. They don't get it in the religious settings. They don't get it in kind of other things like this, they find it in state-sponsored. That's one thing I would want to point out.
Yeah, I think that's you know, that's very that's both a similarity and a difference. I mean, I do think that a lot of people, I grew up in North America and in Canada, and I have friends who, you know, go to church, and I've always found that the community element was probably more important than the religious element. Just going to religious functions and going to religious functions for the, you know, the purpose of worship was one thing, but it's also the sense of community gathering and seeing friends and the coffee hour after the service and all of that aspect. I think for many people is perhaps even more important than the worship and the doctrine specifically around Christianity.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there are, for many people, that's true. For other people who are more kind of born again evangelical, it is, religion is more fundamental, and so we have to remember that our own experience is not necessarily representative of that of many other people. And people, regardless of whether the community is more important or the ideological element, the religious element is more important, it still gives churches a really strong power in the United States, to a lesser extent in the UK, because people still, you know, whether the community element is more important or the religious element is more important, they still provide finances and so on, you know, tithing of 10% of their income, and the political impact of churches, the cultural, the moral impact of churches, of church leaders who are able to take that, the people coming to their church and giving them money as proof of their social, cultural impact. So that is still quite significant and something that was quite different in the Soviet Union.
Yes, and I imagine that's something that's distinctly possibly American in terms of the role of the evangelical churches. That's absolutely very different from not just the Soviet Union, but as you say, the UK and much of Western Europe as well.
Yep, exactly.
Okay, very interesting dissertation and topic. Go ahead.
People who want to check it out, the book is published. It's called Socialist Fun, Youth Consumption and State-Sponsored Popular Culture in the Soviet Union, 1945 through 1970, and it's available on Amazon.
Great. I'll put the link in the show notes. Are there other differences that you spotted, or other?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
So if we want to speak about differences, one difference is that the state in the Soviet Union was the one that was providing funding and not every individual.
Right.
We think in the United States, churches are sponsored by people who go there and tithe 10% of their income or whatever amount. Then community centers and clubs, like, let's say, Kiwanis or Rotary Club or your local, you know, chess club or something like that, or your dance club, they're all sponsored by people.
Right.
They pay out of their own salary. Whereas in the Soviet Union, the state was sponsoring these. So people didn't have to pay a dime. It was very much of a social welfare provision. Now, in the UK, you have a little bit more of that than in the US. You do have the state sponsoring some cultural activities for people, but not nearly as much as people themselves paying for it. In the Soviet Union, this was all sponsored by the state. People had to pay very little, if anything, to go. They got free instruments. They got free music performances, spaces to perform. So it was really very much sponsored by the state. It was seen as a social welfare provision and as a right of a citizen to have that sort of ability to perform and enjoy music. So both amateur performance, the enjoyment of professional musician. So it's kind of like one difference. Another difference was that because the state was sponsoring these, it also censored this musical cultural into ideological channels that were approved by the state. So that kind of was another difference. So both funding by the state and censorship by the state. So it's kind of like, you know, the two aspects of this activity, funding and censorship in channeling people's activities into state-sponsored things that the state approved.
So in it was fairly hierarchical, I would have thought, in terms of the types of activities that that one could get involved in and one couldn't. I mean, great if you wanted to learn to play the flute, for instance, I imagine, but I guess if you wanted to learn rock and roll, possibly not.
Yes, exactly. So rock and roll was something that was frowned upon by the state quite a bit. So you would have a much harder time of learning rock and roll when it was popular in the United States, for example, and in the UK, it would have been much harder. You did get some early rock and roll in the 1980s, or some more permission for rock and roll in the 1980s, but not much at all.
Yes.
On the other hand, you did have a lot of room for things like disco in the 1970s, especially because disco didn't really involve words.
Right.
So it wasn't subversive, you know, just like, okay, like dancing, sure, go ahead and dance, you know, nothing too subversive about that.
right. Disco is always a subject of jokes when I was growing up. As an aside, I think it's sort of it was very specific to the 1970s, and I think it I don't know if it's even come back, but yes, I can understand that disco would have made the okay list. And what lasting legacy did these programs have on some of these societies, if any? Did you look at that?
I think one of the things, I've done a lot of interviews with people who grew up in the former Soviet Union or 50 interviews, and people widely enjoy these activities. This is why the book is called Socialist Fun. You know, it's kind of like an oxymoron of sorts. People generally don't associate socialism with fun. They associate socialism with repression and grayness. But, you know, people who I talked to who grew up in the former Soviet Union, and they didn't have any reason to lie. I mean, you know, the Soviet regime is over. This was interviews I conducted, you know, 5 years ago. So they really They really appreciated these things. They thought that they were really fun, and this was one of the aspects of the Soviet Union that they really enjoyed, and they got a lot out of it. They thought that this was really great and something that they would have much preferred would be there after the Soviet Union collapsed, and it went away because, you know, capitalist Russia doesn't support these things. So this is one of the what they described as a strength of the socialist system compared to the capitalist system, that it did provide them with these things, and they would have much rather that these things were available in post-Soviet Russia and just capitalist systems in general. So this was something that people got a lot of enjoyment from. They got social relationships with others. It really helped them have community bonds and find a sense of meaning and purpose in their lives. So that's really powerful.
Yeah, that is powerful. It's really interesting. And I was listening to, I think we'll touch on the community aspect in a moment, because I think it's very important to your work on purpose. But I was listening to a podcast. It was Sam Harris's podcast. He was interviewing Garry Kasparov, the chess player. One of the things that Kasparov was saying is that, you know, and you know, I don't long for the days of something like the Soviet Union or anything like that. But what he was saying is that the Soviet Union was very much a futuristic project in terms of it had a vision. There was this, as you might call it, a sense of purpose that was. In some, you could almost call it enlightened in some ways, and in that way it was quite positive. And obviously he's now a very anti-Putin person, and he contrasts that with Putin's kind of very sort of medieval way of looking at the world, and it's all about power, and there's no overarching vision, even though both both are systems that are very autocratic. And I thought, you know, that way of looking at the Soviet Union is very interesting. And it's an interesting insight as you describe this in terms of how it must have been to live and grow up in such a system.
Yeah. So Garry Kasparov is definitely someone who was both sort of a dissident in the Soviet Union and right now is opponent to the state. He was semi-distant from the Soviet Union, as right now an opponent to Putin's Russia. So he comes from a more neutral perspective as someone who opposed both, and he can speak to that difference. The Soviet Union was very much a futuristic project, and it wanted to bring about change. And it wanted, and this is why I'm talking about it as an alternative modernity. It wasn't aimed at kind of winning, which is what Putin is aiming at, power.
Yes.
It was aimed at really bringing about an ideal future, which, I mean, in its perspective, in the perspective of the Soviet leadership, it was ideal. I'm not saying it's ideal. Yeah. But it was, it had a vision of a future that it wanted to create that didn't involve just taking power. It wanted to really change people for what it saw as the better. And we can argue whether it's better or not. That's a different topic.
Yeah.
But it really, in many ways, it spoke to many people. And in many ways it didn't, but it spoke to people in a quite powerful way in this socialist fun sense.
It's quite it's very interesting when you describe it, and it is, as you say, it's quite different from Putin's power only type of approach, and arguably the approach of the current administration in the United States. Sense of purpose is interesting coming out of that. However flawed you might want to characterize the Soviet vision, either flawed or impractical. There's something powerful there, and it's similar to any organization that has a strong sense of purpose. In risk terms, an organization that has a strong sense of purpose is more resilient to uncertainty, and it can manage, you know, different headwinds, because the employees and the people who work there, they know what it's all about. And regardless of what happens, if the, you know, there's a change in leadership or whatever, they know fundamentally what the organization exists to do. And, you know, there are loads of case studies of organizations that have been through crises, and those that survive have a very strong sense of purpose and vision. So there's a lot there that I think we can extract. Speaking of purpose, and where I think we can segue is into the work that your most recent book and about finding your purpose using science. And I'm curious, first of all, before we get into the book, your views on purpose and how you know, how you came to be interested in that as a topic.
So my views on purpose, I guess I've always been interested in a sense of meaning and purpose. And when I was young, that's not something I had a strong sense of meaning and purpose for myself. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to explore that. Mm-hmm. And the traditional ways of finding meaning and purpose through religion or through cultural heritage didn't really speak to me, as mm-hmm. they didn't speak to so many other people, you know, which is why we have a lot of people. We know, obviously, we have religion and cultural heritage mm-hmm. right now, but there are so many people who are lacking a sense of meaning and purpose. Mm-hmm. So they are not being spoken to by religion or cultural heritage. And so I decided to do research on this, and I found, and in the behavioral science field, I found that there was quite a lot of research on meaning and purpose. And that's what really helped me cultivate my own sense of meaning and purpose and get my own sense of meaning and purpose. Mm-hmm. However, this research wasn't broadly available. So after writing my dissertation book, which is kind of my academic book, I decided that I really don't want to be stuck in the ivory tower and just be oriented toward, you know, writing for other academics, which is what most academics do. That's kind of the coin of the academic realm.
Yes.
Reputation among fellow academics. Mm-hmm. Now, I always considered myself a utilitarian. Mm-hmm. Utilitarian is a person who basically wants to do the most good for the most number. And writing for something that would impress 50 other academics and get me a job in an Ivy League institution or, you know, Oxbridge, which is, for listeners who are not familiar, is a little bit of a derogatory name for Oxford and Cambridge together. Oxbridge.
Yes.
So I decided that's not the way I want to go, even though I have a lot of really great reviews and people were strongly endorsing kind of, you know, my orientation to that direction. I decided I want to be a science popularizer. So about 3 years ago, I opened, together with my wife, a nonprofit called Intentional Insights. Mm. And my wife, her name is Agnes Ishnevkin. She has an MBA in nonprofit management. And so she knows how to run a nonprofit. And I more of the So she runs the back end, the operation, and I'm more of the front end. I do the content creation and volunteer coordination. And so in that context, we decided to popularize behavioral science for a broad audience. Mm. That's what the nonprofit is about. And one of the areas of popularization was meaning and purpose, popularizing the research for meaning and purpose for folks like myself, for whom traditional ways of finding meaning and purpose don't speak to, and who don't want to fill that sort of strong empty gap in their stomach when they have this, you know, waking up with a sense of like, well, what's it all about? What's the point of it all? And also for organizations that don't have a strong culture of meaning and purpose, because that strong culture of meaning and purpose has been shown by a lot of research to correlate not only with survival of the organization, which I think you pointed out really well, but also with employment, with employee productivity. People who have a strong sense of meaning and purpose are much more productive. So corporations that don't have a strong sense of meaning and purpose within them are losing out on a lot of productivity for their employees. Mm. They have much less employee turnover. So your employees, the employees in corporations, are leaving because the corporations don't have a strong sense of meaning or purpose. And they also, employees have many less sick days mm-hmm. when they have a strong sense of meaning and purpose. So that's, which really hurts productivity, you know, if employees take sick days, and a whole bunch of other things that really hurt corporations mm-hmm. that don't have a strong sense of meaning and purpose. They're, you know, just hit their pocketbooks. That's very clear.
Yeah.
When corporations do work on promoting meaning and purpose, that really helps them have a much stronger sense of much better profit and loss of costs. So avoiding losses. So that's what the book was about. So I decided to write a book called Find Your Purpose Using Science, which helps both individuals find a strong sense of meaning and purpose and helps corporations develop a strong sense of meaning and purpose in the workplace.
Mm.
So that's kind of what the focus of the book was about.
Yeah, a lot of really good stuff there. I think in Western societies, and we talked about not being able to find meaning and purpose in religion, or even in nationhood necessarily. Many people they love their country, whatever that fully means, or are patriotic, but the sense of meaning and purpose is not very is elusive to many people, other than this kind of generic notion of success or high performance or something along those lines. And I'm very curious what you see in the students that you teach, because when I was growing up, it was sort of, it's a bit uncool to find sense of meaning and purpose in religion, or for that matter, your country, but success and money, that's always a you'll never be too shunned for that. But that in itself is not that's I think many people find that empty. What does success mean? To get a job with a high salary or a prestigious title or whatever. And I think it is a very elusive concept, not just for, I'm thinking about people who are sort of my age. I'm in my early 40s, and I know a lot of people who've pursued these sort of career trajectories and attained a level of success, and then find that's empty. Having the corner office, or the prestigious title, or more nice salary. What are you seeing in terms of your students?
So my students actually tend to pursue the same things that the nice corner office, the mm-hmm. high salary. My students grew up in this after the fiscal crisis of mm-hmm. 2008, and it's still impacting them. They still have difficulty finding jobs. Their parents have difficulty finding jobs. They're quite oriented toward economic security.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to, in subtle ways, convey to them that, when they grow up, that's not the right word, in the future, that they will not find it meaningful
mm-hmm.
to have that empty, the corner office, because, like you said, it's the people who, when they do actually succeed, they find that it's empty.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something called the concept of the hedonic treadmill, treadmill, where people essentially keep getting more toys, more money, more prizes, oh, here's a nice car.
Mm.
Oh, here's, nice diamond ring. Here's a nice house. Well, what's it all for?
Mm-hmm.
Why are you doing that? What is the point of it all? Why do you care? And the answer, for success, you're just keeping up with the Joneses at that point. You're just mm-hmm. keeping up with your neighbors. Is that mm-hmm. really what you want your life to be about? That's the concept of the hedonic treadmill. You get pleasure by running in a treadmill, but it's all a treadmill. You don't really get anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You just get more toys.
Yes.
You have that famous phrase, whoever gets the most toys wins.
Yes.
Really, that's really what you want your life to be about. So that's something that the research on meaning and purpose shows, that people who don't have a strong, clear sense of their meaning and purpose suffer great specifically in terms of mental and physical health.
Yes.
They have people who don't have a strong sense of meaning and purpose have more heart attacks. They have more stroke. They have more liver disease. They have more various stomach conditions and so on. They live shorter lives. They have less longevity. Then they have more depression, more anxiety, more risky behaviors, alcohol, drugs, and so on, suicide, so on. That's all correlated with an insufficient sense of meaning and purpose. So that's why I wrote the book, Find Your Purpose Using Science, and I created the web app, which is available at intentionalinsights.org,
a
nonprofit I run. So people can go and measure their sense of meaning and purpose, and then they can do various interventions to help themselves develop a stronger sense of meaning and purpose and then measure themselves again. So it's kind of a very data-driven perspective. When I go to corporations and I do workshops on this topic, I have people in the corporation first take the web app to measure their current sense of meaning and purpose. Then there are a number of interventions which I recommend. And then the corporation measures, uses the same web app to measure their employees' change in their sense of meaning and purpose. And that gives you a very clear data-driven approach to cultivating a richer sense of meaning and purpose, because, you know, that's what it's about. It's about what you rate yourself at. And the web app helps you know the change and difference over time. So it's a very data-driven approach. It's one that's informed by research, and we can talk about the research, but that is what it's about. It needs to be informed by these things in order to be meaningful and relevant.
That's really cool, Gleb. As you were describing that, I think where can you find sort of meaning and purpose and the techniques that are scientifically proven? Well, I'd like to get into that, but just in terms of people who are looking for that, I think one of the challenges is even, you know, there still remains the kind of people who compare themselves to one another, or I suppose one of the areas of resistance might be, well, yeah, there are all kinds of things you can take a Tony Robbins, you know, seminar or workshop or course, or there's all kinds of stuff appearing on the web. There are all kinds of life coaches and things like this. But there's also a sense of, I don't know, perhaps a little bit of embarrassment on you know, all of these things seem a little bit, not all of them, but traditionally, I remember the Anthony Robbins, infomercials that came on at, you know, 11:30 PM, that kind of a thing. And, oh, you're spending $19.95 on a set of, cassette tapes, or, you know, something like this. And, but now I think that's changed a bit, and there's a lot of science, as you say, and there are sites and apps such as yours where people can actually do the work and figure out how to find a sense of meaning and purpose, which is really interesting, very positive and encouraging.
Absolutely, I think, you know, if you look at things like meditation, which is you know, previously it would have been seen as woo, like
yes.
Bob Robbins,
yes,
you know. And now there's still some meditation, I would absolutely say that's true, but some of it has been proven by science.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and even that, you know, not even also the stuff that Anthony Robbins does is very helpful. People have used it, very successfully. But I guess the stereotypical in my mind buyer of some of these products have been people that that are looking for a hack or a quick fix or something like that. You have to do the work, right? And same with meditation. There's it's not a magical solution. You have to put in the work, but there are benefits, and you won't learn how to levitate or read minds, but you'll be happier and more fulfilled, right?
Yes, you will be happier and more fulfilled, and people often don't recognize the benefits of this. So this is why I talk about kind of the things like physical health and mental health, because these are much more concrete, you know. No one wants to have a stroke. No one wants to have a heart attack. No one wants to have ulcers. You know, no one wants to have anxiety. No one wants to have depression. And I speak of this as someone with anxiety. So I suffer from an anxiety disorder. I take therapy. I go to therapy. I take medication. So I know that this is not fun. So this is something that we all can strongly benefit from. And people who are skeptical are just not looking at the science. You know, I would not recommend anything that's not science-based, that has not been researched, you know. I don't know enough about the methods of Tony Robbins to say whether that's science-based content. Therefore, I would not recommend it. I would say I don't know enough about it. I can say things like, you know, things like, let's say, many people use the Myers-Briggs indicator.
Sure.
Well, Myers-Briggs has been shown by research to not be a really good indicator.
Okay.
It's not really valid.
All right. That's good to know.
FYI.
Yeah, that's very commonly used in organizations, and I've always, I suppose one of the benefits it can create some self-reflection, but it's interesting. Sure. Eric, please continue. I'm fascinated with this.
Oh, yeah, so Myers-Briggs has been shown to not be consistent or reliable. The only aspect of Myers-Briggs that has been shown to be consistent is the extroversion versus introversion.
Okay.
The thinking, judging, feeling, perceiving, that has not been shown to be consistent at all. So people can take the same indicator a couple of weeks apart and get different answers. So it doesn't capture a lot of complex things that are actually going on within those categories. Mm-hmm. Extroversion, introversion is the only salient thing.
Right.
So that I can definitively, when people ask me about that, I can say, no, don't use that.
Right.
That's bad.
Right.
When people ask me about other things, I can recommend, you know, a similar thing. I can recommend the Big Five personality test.
Okay.
That's something that has been demonstrated to be consistent by science.
Which one is that? Which one, how can people find that one?
Yeah, Google Big Five.
Big Five personality test. Okay.
Yep. There's narcissism. Anyway, there's Big Five. That has been shown, you know, definitely I can recommend that. Things that I don't know enough about that haven't been studied enough are things like the DISC profile.
Yes.
Test. So the DISC profile is another prominent one. I don't know enough about it to say whether it's research-based or not. So whether it's not, I can't say that it has been disproven. The Myers-Briggs has been quite clearly disproven as like, no, not helpful.
Right, right.
I don't know enough about it. The Big Five personality test, if someone comes to me and says, you know, what do you recommend for that? I say, I recommend this.
Right, right.
So,
okay.
You know, that's the same thing. That's all the things that I recommend that are part of Intentional Insights content and part of my own consulting when I go to corporations and I do consulting on decision-making, on meaning and purpose, on social and emotional intelligence. I only do consulting and the things that I can say are science-based.
Right.
So I don't know enough about the work of Tony Robbins to say whether it's science-based.
Right, okay.
Yeah, well, it may help people, but it may be the placebo effect. So
sure.
Sure.
Let's maybe talk about a few of the tools and techniques that an individual or an organization can use to find purpose that are science, they're science based and science proven, that that you recommend. I think one of those is journaling that you talk about, self reflection and journaling. Is that
yes. So there are kind of four techniques that I recommend, and that have been shown to be strongly correlated with a strong sense of meaning and purpose. One is having a strong, clear sense of your long-term goals and connecting that to your everyday activities.
Okay.
So meaning and purpose in general, the definition of a sense of meaning and purpose in life is having an overarching drive that gets you up out of bed every morning and that causes you to do your activities. So that's the overarching drive. When we talk about a sense of emptiness, lack of meaning and purpose, that means that you don't have that overarching drive.
So when you're waking up in the morning and you're dreading another day of work or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Or, you know, for a corporation, it would be, well, we're doing this just for the money.
Right.
You know, that's a similar thing in a corporate setting.
Or you're doing it because all your competitors are doing it and it's the hot thing and we ought to be doing it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Simply, purely for the money.
Yeah.
So that's kind of create a strong sense of meaning and purpose in your employees or the corporation.
Yes.
Not helpful. And an individual as well. So not helpful. Mm-hmm. Now, having that goals, clear long-term goals, what you aspire to, what your mission and vision statement is, your personal sense of purpose and your mission vision as a company, mm-hmm. that's what really helps you do that. And then not only having that, because it's kind of empty if you just have that, or it's kind of like, well, we have this mission and vision, what does it mean? Mm-hmm. It means connecting it to your everyday activities. Mm-hmm. So connecting your everyday activities to your mission and vision in the long term. And in the book, Find Your Purpose Using Science, I go through that. I go through how individuals and corporations can do that, can cultivate that strong sense of their overarching mission vision and connect that to their everyday activity.
Okay. So if somebody's listening to this and says, well, that sounds great, but I don't really know what my overarching goal or vision and mission might be, what should I do? What should I try?
So the book goes through a number of exercises mm-hmm. that people can try. And that involves finding verbs or finding adjectives that describe what you want to be, that really resonate with you. Mm-hmm. And here you have to tune into your emotions. So things, I'll give you an example for myself. Mm-hmm. So my life purpose is to be happy, fulfilled, and flourishing. Mm-hmm. So happy, fulfillment, and flourishing. That's how I want to live my life, to be maximize my happiness, fulfillment, flourishing. Now, those are adjectives that resonate with me. And for other people, I have heard them resonate with things like beautiful. They want a beautiful life. They want an impactful life. They want a useful life, and so on. So the book lists a variety of adjectives that people have found to resonate with them. And so by figuring out which adjectives resonate with you, what mm-hmm. kind of a life you want to have.
Okay.
Then defining each of these adjectives in a sentence. So for me, happiness is a sense of satisfaction and contentment in my everyday activities with occasional thematic joy and pleasure. Mm-hmm. So that's happiness. So because, again, happiness can mean many things to many people. Mm-hmm. So you want to define what it means for you. Then fulfillment for me means that I am fulfilling my values for myself, for my tribe, which are the immediate people around me, and for the global community, for the global as a whole. And then flourishing for me means that I experience wellness and thriving in my life areas. Now that for me means what are my life areas? My life areas are my personal life areas, so myself as an individual, my life partnership with my wife, Agnes Vishnevkin, who I mentioned before, so that's super important to me. Then my social life area, so people who are close to me, my friends, I consider myself a loyal friend, and that's really important to me. Then my professional life area, so all the things that I'm doing professionally, and then my civic life area, so my impact on the world and improvement of my society. And again, that cashes out differently for different people. So finding those adjectives and then finding and defining each of them in a sentence.
Okay, great. Okay. You mentioned these sort of four areas. Yeah. So one is the sort of mission and vision. What are the other three, if I got that right?
Yep, absolutely. The other three are self-reflection. So reflecting on how your activities help you have experience a sense of meaning and purpose.
Right.
It often is the case that people are connected to their long-term goals and their everyday activities, but they're not realizing that.
Right.
And because they're not realizing it, they are actually not experiencing that strong sense of meaning and purpose.
Okay.
So connecting those things in a self-reflective manner. That can be done through various things. Journaling, using the app that I mentioned, doing meditation that's focused on your sense of meaning and purpose, and other ways, you know, that help you have that reflection.
So it's kind of like saying, I know what my vision and mission is, but, you know, today I did almost nothing that furthered my mission and vision. So it's good to be self-aware of that and look to change it.
Absolutely. Yes, exactly. Or here are the three things I did. Let me note that and let me experience
Right. Or it's, I enjoyed this activity so much and I realized the reason why is because it, you know, it very strongly aligned with my vision and mission, that kind of thing.
Yep, exactly. Okay. And that helps you decide what you want to do more of and so on.
Yes. Okay. Okay, great.
Then there's community bonding, community belonging. Mm. That has been shown by research to be strongly correlated with a strong sense of meaning and purpose. Mm-hmm. So having strong community bonds, social bonds, and that can be, you know, this is a reason why people in religious settings have a strong sense of community belonging, because have a strong sense of meaning and purpose because of community belonging. Research on people who have private religious, who are privately religious but don't have a strong religious community, shows that they have a quite a bit of a weaker sense of meaning and purpose than people who are in religious communities that have that social bond.
Right.
So, and that's why it worked in the Soviet Union to have those community groups that I mentioned to give people a sense of meaning and purpose.
Right. In the course of your research, have you come across the blue zones at all?
The what?
The blue zones.
No.
Yeah, these are a set of communities around the world that have the highest lifespan. And one of the factors, in addition to other things like diet and exercise, is sense of community. So there's a community in, I think it's in Okinawa in Japan. There's another community in Greece. Interestingly, one of the ones is also the Seventh-day Adventist in, I think it's in California or somewhere in the United States, where I think they're also vegetarian as well. So they have good, you know, relatively good diets and, but also very strong sense of community. You know, I think that's, you know, I'm not sure the type of studies that underpin, that work, but it's certainly interesting. And would correlate very nicely with what you're describing in terms of sense of community.
Oh, I definitely believe that. I mean, they likely have a strong sense of meaning and purpose, and that quite clearly correlates with a strong sense of longevity. So there's research showing, you know, meaning and purpose. One of the components of meaning and purpose is community belonging, and a strong sense of meaning and purpose correlates with longevity. So it's highly likely that meaning and purpose, you know, which people have a strong community, they have a strong sense of meaning and purpose, and it correlates with longevity. Also, independently, community correlates with longevity. So both of these things, having strong social bonds also helps people have longevity independently of their sense of meaning and purpose. Both those things, meaning and purpose contributes to longevity, and community belonging contributes to longevity, and community belonging also contributes to meaning and purpose.
Okay. So. Okay. Yeah, very interesting. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And the last thing that's really important for meaning and purpose is serving others, having a sense that you're serving others in some significant way.
Right.
So philanthropy is great, donation, volunteering is great, political activism is, you know, that includes political activism, serving others in some way. And just to clarify, this is not only for individuals, this is for corporations as well. Mm-hmm. And so corporations that do things like employee giving, that, you know, they match whatever the employees give.
Sure.
That's one way of doing that. Another way is organizing employee volunteering together. So that's another way of doing it. So another way is organizing giving games. So giving games are activities where employees come together and then they have a discussion about several charities and then they vote on which charity gives money to give money to. That's another way of getting community belonging.
Right.
So all of these things are ways that corporations, that I've advised corporations and I consulted with corporations on building up their community belonging. So it's all of these things. Self-reflection also applies to corporations. That's where I come and do workshops on self-reflection of the corporation's mission and vision to individuals' mission and vision. Mm-hmm. Community belonging as well. You know, I had things like changing the lunch hours of corporations so that people have lunch hours together and be paying for their lunches. So if they come and have lunch in a group, then the corporation would pay for all of their lunches. This, you know, that's a fee, that's an expense, but it more than pays out in the outcome of having a stronger community, sense of community, and sense of belonging. Mm-hmm. So all of these things are really helpful mm-hmm. for corporations as well as individuals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. In the corporate context, it is interesting. At the same time, you know, you read the stories of Google and the infamous sort of offices and filled with beanbag chairs and pinball machines and things like this, which is on one hand are great, absolutely fabulous. On the other hand, are these ways of keeping people in the office so that they work longer hours? There's a flip side to it, but it is it is very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So whatever other effects those things have in terms of keeping people longer and so on. Things like having lunch together doesn't have the impact of keeping people longer, but it has the impact of building community.
Yes.
And building community is, belonging. Yes. Or corporations, they give people time off to do volunteering together.
Yes.
So that doesn't, that actually involves people staying shorter. So this is a expense for the corporation.
Yes.
But again, it more than pays out in mm-hmm. the sense of serving others and in the team building that gives people a stronger sense of meaning
and
purpose.
That return on investment is also, are you saying, is backed by significant research and
great deal of research.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. No, very very interesting. One of my previous guests, Mark Stoiber, and I'm going to release that episode the next day. He's been involved in branding, and one of the case studies that he loves is Patagonia, the outdoor apparel company. That's precisely the types of things that they do. And one of the things that he mentioned is that even though they don't pay like a hedge fund or anything, they have 3,000 applicants for every job, which is the amount of talent that they can get as a result of one of the things they do is they allow their employees to go when the waves are when surf's up, they you can go out surfing, just take your surfboard, go out surfing, and do the work later, that's as one of the things. In terms of the war for talent, it's definitely a plus for them.
Absolutely. And you have other organizations, so there have been case studies of things in terms of meaning and purpose on Southwestern Airlines.
Mm-hmm.
Southwestern Airlines is really well known for conducting, helping people have a strong sense of meaning and purpose inside the company.
Mm-hmm.
And they've done a number of things which correlate with the science-based content mm-hmm. advice that I give to corporations. Now, they're notorious, well-known for having higher profits than other airlines
mm-hmm.
and greater customer satisfaction
mm-hmm.
than other airlines, less employee turnover, more employee productivity, and so on, because they have, and it's all correlated with a strong sense of meaning and purpose.
Yes. Yes, it does make a lot of intuitive sense, and I think there are this is evolving. Corporates really need to do a lot of work to build trust back with the with their workforce, with the broader population, and with with employees, because millennials are also more entrepreneurial than I think the generation that preceded them. It's not all that cool to work in a major corporate anymore, or it's less cool, certainly. So there's a lot of work to be done on the part of many corporations and medium and small sized businesses as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, we're slightly going over time, but I did want to cover off one area, and that was decision making. This being a show of risk and uncertainty, you've done some work on decision making, and I think first of all, just this stuff. Why are we talking about sense of purpose and this kind of thing? For me, it makes an individual or an organization more resilient to whatever may happen. So it's a better way of managing uncertainty. Which yep. so it may seem, you know, not directly related to risk and uncertainty, but in fact I think it's very very related to risk and uncertainty. But decision making, you've done some work in this area, and you also have a tool and technique that that is also science based. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that and the work that you do in terms of getting getting decisions right. Because decisions, obviously, are the way in which the rubber hits the road in terms of managing risk and uncertainty. And a lot of people actually don't take decisions very effectively, in my view, or they don't take them at all. It's very easy. I'm a natural procrastinator as well, so I put things off myself. And but rather than do that, I think there are some ways in which one can look at uncertainty and options and figure out the best course of action. So very curious of your work in this space.
Sure. So one of the things that people don't tend to think about is decision making, as you said. They tend to think, decision making is just how people make decisions. And they don't realize that there's an actual whole field of science that researches decision making, and that's kind of a field that I'm involved in. There's an area called method decision making, which is essentially looking at the process of how we make decisions. And if we think about it, decision making is at the root of everything we do, from corporate mergers to investments in products to hiring decisions. They're even called hiring decisions.
Yes.
To, which supplier do we work with?
Yes.
Everything.
Yeah, well, and through to which car should I buy? Which school should I send my kids to? Where should we go for vacation? Which should I stay in my job? Should I start this business? Should I, should I stay in this relationship? All kinds of things, right?
Yes, exactly. And we don't think about that we can make decisions better. Mm-hmm. So people tend to go with their guts on decision making.
Yes.
And research shows that going with your gut is mostly good, but sometimes awful.
Yes. I mean, it's good where where you're looking at a decision in an area that you know very well, and you've made the same kinds of decisions in the past. But my understanding is if you're trying to use your gut to make a decision in an area where you don't have any or very little experience or expertise, it isn't going to help you.
I'd push back on a little on the decision making, whether you tended to make decisions in the past. There has been quite a lot of research that shows that decisions where you think of yourself as an expert, you may not be nearly as much of an expert as you are.
Sure.
For example, stockbrokers.
Yes.
Hedge fund managers. That stockbrokers are a prominent example of people who think they make good decisions. They're very confident.
Right.
But actually actively managed hedge funds tend to underperform on average the stock market. So that's a big area of where, no, we shouldn't trust people who consider themselves to be experts going to their guts.
Yes.
And there are a whole bunch of other areas like this.
They over attribute anything that may have been pure luck to their own abilities.
Absolutely. And there are a whole bunch of other areas like this. A number of CEOs are well known for making decisions that are not necessarily good, like going with their guts, and then they still get hired by other companies because they tend to be able to be really good at spinning their decision making, kind of blaming subordinates for bad decisions and getting credit to themselves for decisions that worked out, even though that may be by luck, as you pointed out. So even experts, you have to be, when you deal with an expert, you have to see whether the expert is getting quick feedback based on the decision he or she made, and then whether they're getting penalized for bad decisions. Now, that's the case where with stockbrokers, they're not really getting penalized for bad decisions because they're not really investing their own money.
They don't have any skin in the game.
They don't have any skin in the game. And CEOs, their pay, their incentives are disaggregated from that sort of thing.
Yes.
So
yeah, they get a bonus, but until very recently, you wouldn't claw back bonuses if they got something wrong that didn't pan out. It's a major challenge in corporate governance.
It is absolutely a major challenge. I mean, you work in that sphere, you know that. So people who have expertise, the research shows that you can trust their decision making if they have only in a couple of situations. If they get very quick feedback on decisions they make, and if they get penalized for bad decisions and rewarded for good ones. Mm-hmm. So things like doctors, in most cases, not all cases, tend to be someone you can rely on. Weather forecasters are very well known for being quite well calibrated, because they know pretty quickly about whether they make the right call or the wrong call in terms of percentages. Mm-hmm. And a number of other fields, I'm not going to go into all of them here, but that's basically kind of the thing that you want to look at, whether people get quick feedback and whether they get penalized and rewarded for their decisions in terms of expertise. Now, there are, as I mentioned, people tend to make decisions with their guts, but there are a whole range of systematic ways where our intuitions tend to make mistakes. There are two systems of thinking. One is our autopilot system, what some scholars call system one. I prefer the autopilot system. It's easier to understand. Mm-hmm. It's basically our gut reaction. It's our emotions and it's our intuition. Mm-hmm. And it's very powerful. And it makes decisions very quickly. The decisions that our gut makes tend to feel like they're right. Now, we have another system of thinking, which is our intentional system. That's our logical, rational system. Some folks call it system two. I prefer intentional system. It's, again, more intuitive. That's a system that's deliberative, that's reflective. It takes time to turn on. Mm-hmm. It does not feel intuitively right by definition.
Right.
You know, hard to think through. So I'll give you an example. Let's say your boss is criticizing you. You're in a meeting, your annual performance evaluation, your boss is saying, you did these 10 things wrong. Now, there are two types of people. One type of person would want to intuitively put their fingers in their ears and yell, la, 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 yeah, I can't hear you.
Yes.
That's the intuitive system, you know, our autopilot system. That's the one that originated in the savannah. It's associated with the lizard brain, the mammalian brain. So it's kind of the defense response, the flight response. You know, the fight or flight response. Well,
absolutely,
the other one is the fight response. That's the, you know, that's the person who wants to punch their boss in the face.
Yes.
So those are the two typical intuitive responses. Now, you're probably not going to get very far in the corporate world if you do either of those things.
That's right. Absolutely.
So you have to turn on your intentional system and be like, okay, I need to listen to what my boss is saying and incorporate this into my performance so that I don't make these, you know, 10 oversight mistakes next time.
Yes.
And that's how you get farther ahead. It doesn't feel intuitive. You know, it feels like you're going against your gut reaction. Well, you are. But that's the, you know, that's when you need to not go with your intuition. Mm-hmm. And so there are a number of series of cognitive biases. They're called cognitive biases by scholars. You know, bias like gender, acting bias. But these are not, this doesn't have anything to do with diversity. It has to do with our cognition, our thinking. And folks can look it up on Wikipedia. There's a list of over 100 cognitive biases.
Yes.
Now, it's fun and all to think about, well, our brain is screwed up in over 100 ways. You know, read about all these cognitive biases and get depressed because, you know, we all suffer from them. But that's not what I want to do. That's not my focus. My focus is helping people deal with them. Mm-hmm. So I created tip sheets and guidelines. Mm-hmm. And I write articles and videos and create videos, but the most effective thing is this tip sheet that if anyone wants to email me at gleb@intentionalinsights and tell me that they heard me on the All Risk podcast, I will email you a free copy of this tip sheet. So again, that's gleb, G-L-E-B, @intentionalinsights.org. Or you can look me up online, you know, just Google Gleb Sapursky. It'll lead you to my website, which is glebsapursky.com. And you can find my email there.
Sure.
So if you email it to me, I will send you the tip sheet. Again, tell me you heard me on the All Risk podcast.
All Things Risk, Gleb. All Things Risk podcast.
All Things Risk.
Yes.
Sorry. All Things Risk.
No problem.
Thank you, Ben. Yeah. So All Things Risk podcast. And tells you basically a very structured decision-making process that helps you avoid the vast majority of these biases. Mm-hmm. You do that by externalizing your decision-making and putting numbers on it. So putting numbers on the various decisions, let's say you want to hire someone and you have three candidates and you have various categories for decision-making. Let's say how much you pay each one, how much experience each person has, how good of a fit they would be in the company, how well they fit your needs, the diversity aspects, you know, whether they add to your diversity, mm-hmm. and then you evaluate how important each of these characteristics is. Then you evaluate each potential employee on each of these characteristics, and then you multiply all of that out to make a decision. Mm-hmm. So that's something you can do as a company on any sort of big decision, you know, whether to go into a merger or not, and, you know, which supplier to use. Or as an individual, you know, which of these three cars do you want to buy? Mm-hmm. Which of these vacations do you want to take? Which of these careers, these jobs do you want to take? And mm-hmm. so on. So that's the decision-making guideline that helps you avoid a huge number of these biases.
Okay. Yeah, I looked at the tool. It looks very useful, and you know, I think attaching numbers to these things is a way of it's not trying to be super prescriptive, but I think it does help one, you know, think about and self-reflect and be a bit introspective around what it is you're aiming to do. So I think as an exercise, it's very useful. I think we all should, I think, spend a bit of time in thinking through options and what's important. But I also love the last step, which is once you decide, don't go back.
Yeah. Yes. So one of the things that's part of exercise is that once you decide, you don't want to go back on it.
Yeah.
It's really important to pre-commit to the decision, unless there is significant new evidence that shows
sure.
you know, the decision was wrong. You pre-commit, you say, okay, that's what I'm going with, throw away the other options, because research shows you're going to cause yourself unnecessary stress. And when you waver between decisions and when you cut off your other options and just decide on one, you're much more likely to succeed in the thing that you're focusing on.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, it's a very intuitive tool and certainly very useful. So I'll put the I'll reiterate that in the show notes and make sure that if anyone's interested, they can reach out to you. That's great. We've gone slightly over time Gleb, but you know I do appreciate your taking the time to speak to me. I did want to get into a little bit your work on analyzing the political debates in the US elections, but maybe just said a few words on that. And the I guess the main takeaway from me from that, and I felt the same way. We had the Brexit referendum here in the UK, and I kept thinking throughout the entirety of that campaign that the Remain camp just did not connect emotionally with the electorate, and the Leave camp certainly did. And it was, I think, a similar story in the United States with the, you know, with the Trump election. And I did feel that, you know, Hillary Clinton was just not while she had a great grasp of policy and details, she didn't really connect emotionally with the electorate. We make decisions emotionally, particularly in the political space, perhaps more than any others. And I think it's just a fabulous lesson in how our leaders should communicate with others. Probably easier to do than, I don't know, I suppose you can change an entire electorate's way of looking at things, but that would be perhaps a bit of a harder thing to do.
Well, yes. So very briefly, what, in terms of decision-making, politics is a huge area of great importance. And both Brexit and the Trump election here have been characterized by post-truth politics. Mm. So Oxford Dictionary
yes.
shows post-truth politics as its word of the year
yeah.
in 2016 because of Brexit and the election of Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Post-truth politics refers to politics that focuses on emotional appeals and personal opinion over facts or expert expertise. And that's what postmodern politics is about. And this is hugely dangerous. This is a huge risk for our country and democracy.
Absolutely.
Because if we can get away with winning by lying and emotional appeals, not worrying toward the truth, but orienting toward emotions, you're going to have politicians who win, and then they can be as corrupt as they want because no one can would know how corrupt they are because they can just lie about it. So they can be as corrupt as they want, and we just, as voters, won't be able to tell.
How did we get here, Gleb? How did the world become, the Western world become post-truth? What's your view on that?
So my view on that is that it became post-truth partially through the power of social media, because right now politicians can engage directly with voters through social media without actually going through traditional media channels. And that's one, that is a huge way, and that's something that has been shown by research on how people think, that they are not able to differentiate between credible news channels and kind of alternative news channels, and see that credible news channels, like, let's say, in the UK, The Guardian, are going to be, people equate them with things that are completely not credible, that are brought to them by social media because they trust their friends are sharing good sources, and their friends aren't sharing good sources. So social media is a huge part of the explanation. So for, there's a company called Cambridge Analytica, which has been associated
it's
with...
It's been a very interesting story.
Yes, which has been associated with both the Trump election and Brexit here, which has been using social media as a powerful way of targeting voters and manipulating them. So I think that's a big part of the story, is the rise of social media and the decline of traditional media. You know, traditional media has many less people working in traditional media. People are engaging with it less. They're getting their news much more from social media. So, and therefore, they don't have the kind of filters that have been there previously, where credible reporters have been able to filter out the things that are obvious lies and deceptions, which they wouldn't be reporting those things. They just wouldn't be, that wouldn't be part of the mainstream discourse. And now, because it's in social media, it is part of the discourse and it's really impacting people. And so I've launched a project called the Rational Politics Project to try to get people to care and love truth and reason and logic, not using methods like debate and argument, but using methods that are informed by psychology, by behavioral science, getting people emotionally invested into the truth, pointing out how lack of concern for the truth in politics will lead to corruption and authoritarianism. People don't have an intuitive, most people don't have an intuitive concern for the truth. They don't, their gut reaction, their autopilot system doesn't care so much for the truth. It cares about corruption and authoritarianism. So it's quite effective. And I've had these conversations with a number of conservatives. If you say that, hey, you know, post-truth politics will lead to corruption and authoritarianism, we don't want corruption and authoritarianism, do we? They're like, no, we don't. Well, okay, let's fight against deception in politics. And so that's kind of a project. If anybody's interested in that, they can email me at gleb@intentionalinsights.org and I can get you involved in the project to bring truth to politics. We have a number of people in the UK involved in it, a number of people in the US, and then actually we have people from five continents involved in it. So because people care about this stuff, and it's a big problem.
Very cool. I'll put the link to that in the show notes as well. It is a major problem, and I guess one of the challenges is as well, in my view, there's certainly apathy out there, particularly amongst younger voters, and voters who never really experienced arguably in the United States, one never experienced authoritarianism apart from the McCarthy era, I suppose. You have a generation hasn't had a direct experience with authoritarianism, either as, living under an authoritarian regime or in a world where they existed, more prominently. I mean, having said that, in the Brexit case, the voter, the Leave vote was very largely affected by age and demographics, the older voters voting to Leave, which is another debate, but it's very, very interesting.
Mm-hmm. In the US as well, younger people tended to vote against Trump, mm-hmm. and other people tended to vote for Trump. Mm-hmm. I think the US and the UK are kind of particular situations where we as countries have never experienced contemporary authoritarian dictatorship.
Yes.
In countries that are, let's say, Germany, France,
yes.
and other countries, they have experienced authoritarian dictatorships in living memory. So older people would be less likely to vote for people who are going to bring about authoritarian dictatorships.
Yes.
You know, France, you know, dominated by Germany in World War II.
Yes.
So, and Germany, obviously, a prominent example. So I think that's a big distinction between where it's not in people's historical imagination to have in living memory to have authoritarian dictatorships. Mm.
Yes. Well, we'll see what happens with the French elections later this year, but it's an important distinction. Yeah. We've gone over the time that I had allocated to speak with you, and so thank you very much. And we covered a lot, Gleb. So I do want to wrap it up. But was there anything else that we didn't get to cover that you wanted to?
No, I think this was great. I really appreciate you having me on the show. And I look forward to hearing from guests of yours who want to perhaps have me on as a consultant for themselves or as a speaker, who want to grab a copy of my tip sheet, which, again, they can email me at gleb@intentionalinsights.org. And if they're interested in consulting or speaking, they can look up at my website, which is glebsapursky.org.com. They can also check out Intentional Insights, the nonprofit, at intentionalinsights.org. And they can, if they're interested in getting involved in the Rational Politics Project, again, email me at gleb@intentionalinsights.org.
Brilliant. I'll put all those links in the show notes. Gleb, this was fabulous. Thank you for joining me today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on, Ben.
All right. Thanks. Bye for now. I thought that was great. Gleb is so insightful. I really enjoyed talking to him. And this is another one of those podcast episodes in which the show notes will be your friend. So if you wanted to follow up or learn a little bit more about anything we talked about, you should be able to go to the show notes and find the link that you're looking for. And of course, and as mentioned, drop Gleb a line and mention that you heard him on the All Things Risk podcast, and you can get a copy of his decision-making tip sheet. Gleb@intentionalinsights.org is how to do that. If you liked what you heard, well, we have now 45 great full episodes of the All Things Risk podcast and 13 shorter in-between episodes where it's just me and the microphone and I talk about things and provide a few tips and tools. Go to allthingsrisk.co.uk and you can find all that great content, and you can find all the ways to subscribe to the show. We are found wherever great podcasts are found. What would be great, if you have a moment, is if you could leave a rating or a review on iTunes. That would help us out a lot, because what it does is it bumps us up a little bit and provides just a little bit more visibility to other people who could also find the show and get some great insights from people like Gleb. If you have any feedback for me, allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the best place to do that. And that's about it for this week, everyone. We will be back next week with another full episode in the interim. And as always, don't forget, risk is life.